Cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday evening, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 239th weekly episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 238 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe only one email per day, and it's free. On next Sunday, July 22nd, my guest will be academic and ethicist, an ex-Wall Street technologist, Herbert Rosman. I hope you'll be with us then and every Sunday night for this year's season. Before going any further, a few announcements. I was the featured speaker on Saturday, June 23rd, at Iona College on International Business, Economics, and Environment Conference, in which I spoke about personal artificial intelligence in the home office, demonstrating on an Amazon Echo. I'm in the process of revising the PowerPoint that support the presentation so that it will be more robust for those who did not get to the presentation but asked for the material. If any listener wishes a copy, please email me at johnmack13@gmail.com, and that's johnmack13@gmail.com, and ask for one. The second thing, and then this is really only of appeal to locals in the upper Westchester, the lower Connecticut area, the John C. Hart Library in Shrub Oak, New York, will host a special Meet the Authors event at 1 p.m. next Saturday, July 21st. Local authors in upper Westchester Putnam will discuss their work, and things will be available for purchase and signing. Now, to this week's show. As mentioned, the 239th in the series, my guest is Giselle Hausman, who describes herself as an email evangelist, a communications expert, and a life skills artist. But I met Giselle, if met is the proper word, first through her writing and her latest book, and then the rest of her writing about marketing and publicizing one's writing, that topic dear to my heart, and then through emails back and forth. The listeners wishing to join Giselle and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guests. But let's get started. Welcome to the show, Giselle.
Happy to be here, John.
Now, where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Austria, and it's really a country that's famous for its music and Schwarzenegger and all kinds of things. But there are a few people who don't ski, like me, and who don't climb mountains, like me. And eventually we get kicked out, which is not actually true. I left voluntarily. But anyway, I did grow up in Austria in the mountains and eventually found my way to the Mid-Atlantic region in the United States. And I love it here.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were in when you were young?
Yes. I wanted to be an adventurer. Now, I have to state something before why the thought was conceived. My father was one of four principals in this Austrian city where I grew up. And you have to picture, it's the Alps, kind of like the Heidi Buchtel, Heidi plays out in Switzerland. It's kind of looking similar. So you have a few cities in the valley, and then you have a lot of little villages in the mountains, and they're all connected. So we lived in the city, in the valley, and my father was one of the principals that that ran a school up in the mountains, and of course everybody knew us. Now, this was about the worst detriment of my childhood. You could not do a prank, because if you did a prank, somebody was going to tell your father. I mean, my father was the kind of guy who every now and then gave a bad grade, right? So somebody whose kid may have had a bad grade may have seen me or my siblings doing a prank and then immediately report to my father, well, here you are reprimanding my child, and guess what yours is doing, right? So in other words, I was tied to the house, if you so want, or at least not doing any pranks. So I...
You mentioned the siblings. How many were in the family?
Three, but one was the baby. So it was basically my older sister, myself, and my brother, and we're all 1.5 years apart. So basically I resorted to reading, and I read every adventure book there was. We had a decent library, and I was through the children's book section at age 10, at which point I got permission to read from the adult section. And this was, of course, the time when there was no erotica at the public library, right? So it was like whatever you could read, you could read. If you managed to get through Poe or Shakespeare, well, then more power to you. But I didn't read Shakespeare and Poe.
Did you mention all of the reading that you did and you're writing now, did you write for your school papers or any literary magazines while you were in either grammar school or high school?
We didn't have anything of that. Austrian school system is different than the American school system. And Austria school focuses on learning everything. That's it. The end. It's purely academic. There are no extracurricular activities. We didn't have any sports teams. And the only thing that we had were orchestras. But again, they weren't really tied to the school. It was more that the conductor of this orchestra, who was also a music teacher at the school, recruited students for the orchestra at the school.
Okay.
So long story short, I fled into fled to the library, and I rented everything. I read everything. Heinrich Harrer, Through Tibet, Hans Huss, Conquering the Oceans, everything that was remotely adventurous. And in the process, I decided, these people are regular people. They weren't born with a Superman cape. Obviously, this is doable. That's what I'm going to do. The end. And even to manifest this thing, Heinrich Harrer, the teacher of the Dalai Lama, came to the little village, the little city where I grew up. And he toured with his book. Of course, I already owned the book. So I crammed my book under my shoulder, and I sat in the first row, and I saw his dear slides and everything, and I was like out of my shoes. This is what I was going to do. I was going to go there. So after his done with his lecture, I'm standing there with my book to get it signed, and he looks at me, and I'm like 12, 13 years old, right? And he says to me, "Are you going to go to Tibet?" And there was literally no other reply but yes. You couldn't say no, right? So I said yes. And he looked stern at me and said, "Hurry up. The Chinese are going to destroy Tibet." Okay.
Wow.
So here I am. Well, it was like, it was almost like an imaginary contract with him, right? He asked me, "Am I going to go?" I said yes, and then he said, "Hurry up." So
I know that you
time
eventually did, but wasn't that after college? Did you go to college in Austria also?
Right. So then I graduated high school and wanted to study zoology because I wanted to become a marine biologist. And that idea was kind of like, yeah, I got a dent because I was made aware of that I would have to take a major part in chemistry. And that's something that I don't like. And also I realized how complicated it was to finance any expeditions or whatever. I mean, we were talking the early 80s, so this was, the goal was getting less attractive. And at the same time, I met a couple of filmmakers. And I realized the filmmakers have the money to go to the awesome places. So I switched studies and enrolled in Arts of Film Theater and Mass Media. And then I slowed down my studies because I was shooting simultaneously movies, commercials, PSAs, even feature movies, movies for TV and what have you, and at the same time I was also studying. And in the midst of all this, 18 months before I'm graduating, I suddenly found a hole in my calendar where I could leave Austria for 5-6 weeks and not be burdened with having to shoot movies because it was winter. And college was out for Christmas and New Year's vacation and, you know, that kind of a thing. So I hopped on a train and went to Tibet. Because it was just the right thing to do. And I knew I was working against time. And now picture me, so I'm going with the Trans-Siberian Railway. I didn't have much money. So I couldn't just fly there. I took the train to Moscow, then took the transit to Beijing. Before that, I still got to Harbin, the city of ice, which is like the most amazing thing you can possibly imagine. Now, today, it's like a big tourist trap. But when I was there, it was literally Chinese people cutting ice blocks out of rivers, out of real rivers, not the one artificially making the ice. They had the real river, the real ice, and building these structures on bamboo scaffolding. It was amazing. And it was minus 40 degrees. This is when I learned that minus 40 Celsius is minus 40 Fahrenheit when I was there. But I survived that, then I got to Beijing, and then I got to Tibet. And when I got to Tibet, it was possibly the closest thing to Heinrich Harrer's expedition. There were only two hotels where tourists could stay. Two. One was so far that I couldn't walk there. There was no. I mean, you literally get from 200 meters elevation to 12,000 feet in 1 hour. So it was
wow.
Rather strenuous. And so then I was there, and you had to walk everywhere. You had to be cautious with everything you had to eat. But there was nobody there. I was there in January. There were like maybe 50 tourists in all of Lhasa. So the Patala, the palace, is 378 feet high. You have to walk that by foot. And you have to be able to do this in 12,000 feet. So I trained every day. I was even going to be able to make this. There were people that had been 2 weeks in town and they had never been up there. And that's, of course, where the Dalai Lama lived. So on day four, I was ready to walk up there. I got there relatively early at 9:30 in the morning. I had made it up there. And I stood by myself, alone by myself, in the bedroom of the Dalai Lama. And I'm not big into meditating or anything of that nature, but on that spot it got me. It was just such a magnificent atmosphere. I mean, there were his throne and bed and his podium where he stood, and the open curtains and the blowing in the wind, and everything just radiated. I don't want to say holiness, but magic. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, he has spoken near me, and I wasn't there, but my wife and my son were. There's the Buddhist monastery, maybe 5 miles from me, and my family said it was the same kind of experience. Just hearing him, it was calming.
Well, he wasn't there, but it was this room, it was this atmosphere where you felt
right,
closer to God. If there is a God, you were closer. And I would argue this in front of every atheist. I mean, it was just magnificent. So anyway, this is in 1987. Now, it's been 27 years since then. Right? And in the meantime, and I learned a valuable lesson in all of this. In the meantime, where I used to walk barefoot on a dirt road, there is a 5-lane highway.
Wow.
I couldn't even buy a postcard there. There was nothing there. The only Western thing that I saw was Coca-Cola cans, but that was it. I stayed in a hotel that was like a local hotel. Under the windowsill was a 1-inch gap where the cold air came in January. I slept between two mattresses. Like I said, it was as close as it could be to Heinrich Harrer getting there during World War II. And it was,
wow.
But it didn't matter because you were there and nobody else was there. Meantime, they have an elevator in the parlor, so all the tourists can be catered up. 2,500 tourists are being marched through this holy place every single day. And they have hotels with golden swimming pools and what have you. Literally, you can literally say what Harris told me when I was a kid, the Chinese are going to destroy it. That's what happened. Because they, and I don't want to degrade Disney's world. Because Disney is Disney. It's meant to be an amusement park. Only what I want to say is that the Chinese turned the holy places of Tibet into a Disney world. And the Parva was not meant to be Disney world.
Well, obviously, they weren't into the holiness in Tibet either. Well, then you went back to college. Did you go right into the master's program after college, or did you do more traveling?
Oh, I traveled a lot. And then I traveled close to 97,000 kilometers. I traveled everything that I, wherever I could. But I was kind of systematic. So I traveled all of Europe. I traveled vast parts of the United States, Costa Rica, and a lot in Asia. I crossed Russia twice, once on my way to China and once on my way to Mongolia, which was another one of my big, big goals, getting to seeing the vast nothing, and the big sky of Mongolia. And it's just like breathtakingly beautiful. And I traveled to India we are quite a bit in Asia. But if there is one lesson to be learned, because each country is different and people have different interests, if there's one lesson to be learned, then it is go now. The Harrer principle still applies. If you wait, whatever it is what you want to see, it will be different. If you asked me in 1987, will Tibet stay the same? I would have said yes, and here is why. I had to go to Chengdu, get on a flight to Tibet. And it wasn't like this was easy. If they felt there was an unrest, they canceled the plane. The plane basically flew over the Himalayas, so every now and then there was bad weather, turbulences, or what have you. The plane didn't fly. And so it was hard to even get there. And once you were there, conditions were difficult. But the Chinese overcame that because they built a railroad. And the highest elevation this railroad overcomes is 16,000 feet. Now, who would have thought they could do that even?
Right,
and
sure.
With that train, they overcome everything because basically they put the tourists in. The train ride takes 7 days. And in the train, they can adjust the oxygen level. So by the time the tourists get up to Tibet, they are acclimatized. And not like mountain climbers or myself, basically getting from 200 meters into 12,000 feet and then having to deal with this. So that's how they overcame it, and that's how they—that's why they now have so many tourists there, which at the time they couldn't have done.
When you came back, and then you wound up with the masses. Did you continue in the film business in Austria, or did you
yes.
or did you travel,
yes.
or what did you do after
yes.
after you
yeah,
the masses?
I stayed in the movie industry, and then I met my future fiancé, and he was an aerial photographer. And basically, his work used to be taking pictures of factories and industrial complexes and what have you, occasionally even a big tourist attractions like Schloss Schönbrunn or something like that, because you can't really take a picture of these huge buildings because what you get is a picture of the entrance door or some outstanding feature and that's it. So he did aerial photography pictures and he wanted to involve me in this business and I wasn't interested because he wasn't excited. And then he had this grandiose idea that he was going to do a coffee table book about Vienna. And he shared his ideas with me, and I had always been a book collector since I was a kid. So I told him that what he wanted to do was not good, and here's how I would do it. At which point, I immediately had a different job. I was designing this book. Now, the book itself had very little text because it was basically just meant to describe what the picture shows. So you have like description of around 100 words next to every picture. But there isn't substantial text or anything important. It's all about the pictures. But of course, the book had to be designed in a way that people who didn't know Vienna would know where this building is or in connection. Or like Vienna has a lot of historical districts, in which historical district it is and where the district is and so on. So that's what I did. And suddenly, I was out of the movies and was into books. So that's how it began.
Did you keep writing then? And what eventually brought you to the U.S.?
Oh, my husband and I always wanted to immigrate to the United States. I originally wanted to immigrate to the United States because I wanted to work in the American motion picture industry. If you work in, if you do movies in Austria, you're basically tied to winning the Oscar for the best foreign movie, but that's it. And so that's why I was always shooting to go to Hollywood. And then when he and I met, it just changed, but our plans had always been the same. So we just adapted to that, and that was that. But what I meant to say about how I got into the book business, now in contrast to what's going on today, then book publishing was like completely different from what it is today.
Sure.
You had to shell out money before you talked to somebody. Because even if you talked to a printer, and even if the printer was your best friend and was going to do their job for free for you, which nobody did, but I'm just saying, they had to buy the paper. Because printers don't have any paper because they print precisely on the paper that you select. So you have to buy the paper. And then you have to tell them everything about printing and binding and what have you. You have to study the industry from the ground up. Because it's clear, you're laying out upwards of $5,000 before you can even sell a single book. And that, of course, is immense pressure because you've got to hit it. I mean, that's the only thing you can do. And I am somehow always appalled when I see today's authors, when they rail against Amazon. Oh, my God, Amazon does do nothing for us. And what all they are doing to restrict them in their endeavors. These people don't understand that Amazon gave them the freedom to publish. Because if we really go back to the early 2000s, yeah, the e-reader was a concept, but somebody had to pay to develop it. Now, Barnes & Noble wasn't going to do it, right? Because they were going to hurt themselves if they were going to develop the e-reader, because they had 871 bookstores. So they weren't going to do it, which basically left the only two people who was going to do it, Jeff Bezos, or, of course, Steve Jobs. But if Jobs would have done it, it would have been more expensive because everything that Steve Jobs is more expensive than what Bezos does. So basically all the authors Jeff Bezos a big time thank you that they can even write what they wanted to write. And because that's the reality. People who don't have $10,000 stashed away.
I agree totally, and I think that what he did so well, and I just talked about this, was that I looked at ebook readers. RCA had one, but there was very few books out there. Well, all of a sudden, he realized that you had to have, number one, you had to have a device. Two, you had to have an inventory, which obviously Amazon had from the book business, and you had to have a delivery method. He brought everything to the table all at once with the Kindle, and it just destroyed everything else.
I self-published one book that I self-printed in 1998 before e-reader and PO demand. And at the time, and I can say this today, I even tricked Baker & Taylor to give me a contract and become a distributor. Now, at the time, Baker & Taylor only distributed to publishers with 7 to 14 employees. And, of course, I was alone, right? But I tricked them into giving me a contract. And by basically asking a friend, I listed the book with Amazon. And as soon as I listed it with Amazon, Barnes & Noble listed it too. They didn't have the books. But they listed everything that Amazon had just so they would look as if they had it. So then I had a friend of mine buy 30 books and shell out $600. And, of course, I was going to get back 40% of that. But anyway, so it cost me, if you so want, $320 to get a contract with Baker & Taylor. But they came to me and said, hey, can you please sign on with us? So then I was with them. And I had thought that this was going to help me to get my book into all the little bookstores and all that. It wasn't like that. It was very, very difficult because they would order three books to one of their distribution center. Then these three books didn't sell within the next 3 months. So they send you back two books because the one sold, and they send you back two books. In the meantime, they ask you to send three books to another distribution center, and you basically spend your time sending books to distribution centers and keeping a record of how many books you send and how many books they send back. On top of it, if they had a book damaged at the bookstore or whatever, they sent you back the damaged book, so now you paid the shipping to Baker & Taylor, you get the damaged book back, and you paid the shipment for the damaged book back out of your own pocket, too. People who don't know what they have, people who rail against Amazon don't know what they have. Because
What was your first book?
My first book, I first did this Vienna book that we talked about, then I did an Austria book 5 years later. And then another 5 years later, in 1998, I published Obvious Letters. And it was an early childhood education book. Basically, it was teaching how to teach the alphabet with the European method. And like I said, I approached two vendors, and one of them was Amazon. I distributed myself to local bookstores in South Florida. And then I distributed to Amazon, which was easy, as always. And then I had Baker & Taylor. And in 2004, Baker & Taylor readjusted. And but as soon as I figured out how complicated Baker & Taylor was, I geared all my marketing to that everybody was going to shop at Amazon. And all the teachers did. And that was very good for me. At one point, I want to say it was in 1999 or in 2000, my book was number one of all in ABC books on Amazon. But
much of your writing now focuses on advice to writers on marketing and publicity. What made you hone in on that subject?
Well, I did a lot of marketing over all those years. But then I originally, so my first ebook which I published was basically my adventure stories of all the many travels that I did and many other things. And that was Naked Determination, 41 Stories about Overcoming Fear. And it won two awards and sold very nicely. And then my following book was the email book. And that came about in a really funny way, too. My husband died in 2000, so then I was a single parent and, you know, always had to have a job and provide for my children and do everything and whatever. And I had an awesome job at a construction company in Wilmington, North Carolina. And then the Great Recession came. And needless to say, people in the construction industry got laid off first. And so I suddenly found myself out of a job in May 2008, not because I did anything wrong, but because the recession was about to start. And there was luck in this too, because Bernanke was still talking about Fannie and Freddie are fine and there is no recession. But I already knew that there was a recession because I'd worked in the construction industry. We had one contract and the banks didn't let out any money, so I knew where we were, even though everybody was lying. So rather than taking my unemployment, which I was getting, I was looking for a job like crazy. And I found a job in the transportation industry, and I had worked in transportation, but not in container shipment. And I was like totally out of my league, but I had to keep the job, and I knew that. So I did what they always tell everybody. If you are in a bad position, work your strongest suit. Don't try to fix what you can't do. Work your strongest suit. So my strongest suit was communication. It wasn't knowing everything about hazmat shipments or anything. It was communication. I wrote emails like you wouldn't believe it, like the god of emails themselves. A year passes. The president of the company goes to our overseas client, and they tell her, Gisela is your best person. Now, I knew that that wasn't true. I knew it. But they said what was really the most important thing. She cares. And I did care. I really cared. I wanted to keep this job. And I wanted to make these people happy. And that radiated to my email, through my emails. And so there was that. And as soon as the vice president heard what was going on, she promoted me. And I got the corner office. And I was now in charge of checking everybody's email correspondence, making sure that we suddenly had a perfect communication style with everybody. And so because everybody's emails was running over my desk, including emails that project managers didn't see but I saw, I knew what worked and what didn't work. And I basically analyzed 100,000 emails in 4 years. And then I published my book, Naked Words 2.0, The Effective 157 Word Email. And it was the result of what I had found. And then from then on, it spun off into hints for a publisher. And then I wrote my book about how to get book reviews, Naked Truth About Getting Book Reviews, because in the meantime, I'd also become an Amazon top reviewer, and I got a lot of emails from authors who wanted me to talk me into reviewing their book. And I saw what was wrong, and basically it can be summed up in one sentence. An author is not a plumber, and I don't mean to discredit any plumbers, but their stronghold is not, their strong suit is not mincing words. They are doing pipes and all kinds of stuff. If an author sends you an email with a bad wording or an impolite email or an email where stuff's missing or writes my book instead of listing his book, you immediately know that that author is not a good author. The end. Now, there may also be authors that are good authors and they just don't know how to do it. And that's why I wrote my book. And it was incredibly successful. But then, of course, Amazon changed their guidelines, and in the meantime, I'm on the fourth edition of this very book because it cut, Amazon's guidelines change, and so that affects that, of course. And then I also wrote Naked News, How Not to Invest Your Marketing Dollars, because I'm appalled by all the scams that are out there. And basically, that goes back to my past as being a single mother of two children, having to be a parent, having to work, having to upkeep the house, do the laundry, the yard, drive the kids to extracurricular activities. I know what it's like not to have the money or not to have the time or not to have both. So when I see people just simply scamming indie authors, I get really furious. And that's why I wrote that book.
Then you also have other things, how to get more out of Facebook. So you must have been active on Facebook also.
Well, like I said, I don't want to say that Facebook is a scam, but they are far short from their original mission. Because their original mission was to get people together. And, of course, they had to make the money so they can upkeep their business. And so they were doing ads. But in the meantime, this is all way advanced. And authors who are still operating under the impression that that original system, I can connect with all my fans, they're going to have a problem because this is not how it works. And so I don't want to say it's a scam, but it's a misunderstanding. And that's why I wrote a book about Facebook, specifically geared for authors, but of course the same principles apply to small business owners, what to do and what not to do, so you get your goal, namely conversing with your fans and using Facebook as a platform.
One of the interesting things that's grown up on Facebook, though, there are some wonderful poetry sites. There's a poetry of this, poetry for that, poetry superhighway, where there is a community of poets that's come together. They're not selling to each other, but they're working together. I find that very interesting.
That's basically the tenor of my book. Forget the product pages, like a product page for my book or a product page for my business, and head for groups, because that's really the best way to use Amazon, Facebook effectively as a small business owner or as an author or any kind of other artist, of course. But in the meantime, I've kind of let these projects, the communication projects, aside, and my latest product is a fable. And
it's terrific. I was just going to ask you about this. Are We Nuts is a complete departure from your previous thing. Tell us about how you got this concept.
It's not really a departure because I used to read these books. And I was always fascinated with them. And what fascinates me so much, and this is basically where it connects to communication. Like, for instance, and this is interesting. So I wrote a series, The Little Blue Book for Authors. And one of them is 53 Do's and Don'ts Nobody's Telling You About. And the next one is 101 Tricks How to Make Facebook Work for You. And then The Good Manners Guide for Authors. And the 53 Do's and Don'ts have 46 reviews. The Facebook book has 17 reviews. And The Good Manners have one review. And it's basically, if you want to sum up the contents of these three books, the 53 Do's and Don'ts talk a lot about legal stuff and traps to avoid, basically like the essence of publishing and how it connects with legal stuff. Facebook is about Facebook, and the good manners are the good manners. But people would like to hear what they want to hear. So if a book tells them, hey, you know, don't be rude to a reviewer, or put some effort in, or show some manners or whatever, they may not even want to hear this. It's my worst-selling book of all. And Facebook, the Facebook book is not creating happiness, because I'm basically saying, look, you have these and those options, but avoid these other 100 options, because they're not going to lead you anywhere. So now this is, of course, good advice, but it's not the advice that people would like to hear, because they want to hear tricks. If I just do this, that and that is going to happen. But I can't offer that, because Facebook doesn't offer it. So when we listen to any kind of warning or to any kind of advice, we will perceive the advice or the warning as good as we are willing to go. If we want to climb Mount Everest and one book says, hey, you know, just go there, charter a plane and walk up there, we might like it. And if the book says, well, you have to train for 10 years and you have to climb I don't know how many mountains before that, only a small number of people wants to hear that. So if I'm addressing a big problem that everybody should hear about, then maybe I shouldn't phrase my warning as a warning, but package it into a story that takes it away from us people. And that's basically the trick that George Orwell used in his Animal Farm. Because
right.
He could have told his same story, naming Stalin and Trotsky, and naming all the dumber animals, like the horses, that are just the hard workers, but get basically sold off when they are dying and are going to be made, turned into sausages. So he didn't say that, but he used animals to tell the stories, and that's why it's still popular. Orwell wrote this book in 1946. Stalin's been dead for decades. People still read it because they want to read it this way. And that's why I wrote a fable. And basically, my fable tells a story that happens after the great floods happened and the mankind is wiped out. And there are surviving squirrels. And they are now reliving the history of the United States. You have George Squilton, who is a squirrel leader, and Benjamin Franknut, and the two of them talk all the other squirrels into forming a republic. The 13 states on the East Coast form a republic, and they move from the trees into burrows and form a life together, and they have a constitution, and they're working together, and they set up the Deer Express, and da-da-da-da. And life is still hard till Steve Icewell comes along. And, of course, that's leaning on Steve Jobs. And he finds out that the smartphones that are in the deserted human dwellings can be used for communication. And now the squirrels, with the help of the Deer Express, delivered their smart boxes to all the tribes, and this now elevates their society. Because now they can go and communicate with the other squirrel tribes. If a tornado is approaching, one tribe can signal to the tribe to the west or the east, hey, tornado is coming, right? Or if the burrow is destroyed, then the other squirrels can send nuts to that borough and so on. So their squirrel society begins to advance, kind of like the America advanced in the 18th century with the Industrial Revolution. Now some they also manufacture goods now, and straw mattresses and all kinds of and chestnut cups and fur blankets and all kinds of stuff, and the society moves ahead. And now the tribe council starts acting against the squirrels. because they know something which the squirrels don't. And instead of acting for the squirrels and doing their job as the tribe council, protecting the squirrels from all dangers, they're ignoring it so they can make money. And that's what my favor is all about. And of course, it's not hard to see that it's an allegory, that that's what's happening. Because for a long time, you have like all the squirrels working on the same goal as long as the hardships are going. And as soon as things get to be easier, some squirrels want to have it easier for themselves.
And it brings us to where we are. It's very interesting, I think, that you've chosen squirrels for your main characters. We feed squirrels here, and they in the beginning it was that they were taking the birds' food and it really bothered them. How do we stop them? And then you start watching them, and they are so ingenious. They are so acrobatic. They are so interesting animals that we normally don't think of them as being as interesting as they are. But I really think they're fascinating.
Squirrels are fascinating, and I thought long about it. I only wanted to take one species. I didn't want to make this, you know, like Animal Farm, working together of many species. I thought long and hard which species I was going to take. Now, it turns out that squirrels are either the seventh or the ninth intelligent animals living on planet Earth, and they have basically the level of primates. But among all animals, squirrels are the only ones who can trick others. And what they do is, if they try to bury nuts and they think that they are being observed, or they are in fact being observed and they notice it, they will fake bury the nuts and then take their nuts and bury them somewhere else. So they're basically tricking whoever watches them. This is the only species on this planet that can do that. Also, squirrels don't just bury nuts. They basically sort their nuts by weights and by type of nuts and bury them in a way that would resemble your pantry, like all the boxed goods in one shelf and all the cans in another one, and the cans divided by vegetables and pie fillings and whatever. And so if you find nuts in one hole, it will be only one kind, but it will not end up being another one. So they're highly intelligent, and of course, since they come in all colors, black, white, gray, brown, and what have you, it was, of course, perfect to also describe the American society, because we too come in all colors, and needless to say, there's a few tiny conflicts built in there, too.
One of the funny things that they do here is we put out ears of corn for the deer, and the squirrels will put this large thing of corn, this ear of corn, in their mouth, and they'll go running up the hill to take it someplace, up a tree or someplace. But it's so funny seeing this little squirrel with this big ear of corn running away, so none of the other squirrels or the ground hogs come after it to get the ear of corn. It's very funny.
Yeah, and they are the Native American symbol of thriftiness and resourcefulness. And even the Native Americans recognize that squirrels are outstanding among other animals. So if you so want, I can say it was a fun project, but basically it's an intelligent project, because I was able to weave the entire history of the United States in and describe the process. And the squirrels are clever enough that they can do things that made me use these things from my book.
Now, how are you marketing it? Since you know how to market other things, how are you marketing this book? How are you getting it out there?
Well, right now I'm working on getting a mailing together to all. And my main goal with this book is that I get it to young people. Because basically this book explains that the government is working together via lobbying and also via bribery and via all kinds of activities, which is not necessarily in the interest of the squirrels. And that's something that is, so to speak, usually not being talked about. The whole lobbying topic hardly ever comes up in the media. We'll talk about certain acts, or about certain events, but what happens behind the scenes is not being talked about. And that's what is important to me, because in my story, I have a bunch of flawed heroes. My squirrels are not Superman. They have like various interests. One student that wasn't allowed to take to do the things that he learned in college, and his best friend who actually wanted to do something else, but he doesn't want to leave the best friend, and the librarian who is the overlooked librarian, and all these kind of squirrels, and the nutcracker champion who really just is so smart but isn't appreciated, and so on. And basically, they all follow their own interests. But when they all get pushed on the same topic, they work together. And because they work together, they can solve this puzzle, which is basically what our society does too. All of us have our own interests and have to follow our own path. But if we work together, we can get the right people into office that represent our interests as a society. So I want to get this book out to you. There's always hope. My book is not really, somebody said, I don't want to read an Orwellian fable. It's not an Orwellian fable because there's hope. And of course there is hope all the time. I want to get it out to young people. So right now I'm working on setting up a mailing distribution with colleges and high schools. Because that's where I want to get my book, really.
And it's listed on Amazon both as a paperback and as a Kindle book. Is that correct?
Yes. Of course, it's always a good idea if parents buy it for their children. that is self-understood. It's listed as a paperback and as a Kindle, but it's also available in the EPUB version on iTunes and Barnes & Noble and Kobo and who have you. And I'm also working on an illustrated edition in hardcover. But because it has to be illustrated, that one is not published yet, and it will come out in October on International Nut Day.
Now, it lists a co-author with you. Who is the co-author? Or
no,
is that an editor?
My editor.
Who is...
Yeah.
Oh, that's your editor.
She has edited my last, dozen books. She's really good. And, you know how hard it is to find the right editor. So I finally found her, and she does all my books.
I think we have a caller on the line. Let me see if the person has a question for you. Who do I have from the 914 area code, 3110?
Hi, John. It's Bob Zaslow from Washington State.
Hello, Bob from Washington State. Have you been listening to Gisella?
I've been listening only for the last 15 minutes or so. I was, remember, we're 3 hours behind you guys, so I got in late. I was doing a lot of stuff outside. But, Gisella, my question for you is, maybe you answered it previously, but who is... What are the squirrels trying to accomplish? I know in general, I have a general notion, but what is their main goal, and who is the, what are the obstacles, or who is the obstacle in their way of achieving it?
Basically, what's happening is that Harry, who is a descendant of President Theodore Roosevelt, and his great-grandpa, the only surviving member of his family, are living a life in which they recognize that it's good. But they also have unfulfilled needs and unfulfilled hopes and all kinds of things. And then suddenly a refugee shows up. And she's a black squirrel that's coming from the Texas area. But of course, Texas at that part is not part of the squirrel union yet because it didn't happen in history. And this squirrel is not being into tools to everything that's happening at Nottingham, the capital of the sewer state. And while they lead her around and show her things, they suddenly discover that there are weird things going on. And they may not have seen this if the refugee wouldn't have shown up, but she did. So they noticed this, and they noticed certain weird things happening. And great-grandpa, who is, if you so want, a Yoda figure in my book, says, okay, there's something wrong, and, you know, we don't know what it is, which is basically how it's happening in our life. Very often we know that something is off, but we can't pinpoint what the real problem is. And in all these individual squirrels now decide to follow the trail. They're all, and basically it's described as follow the peanuts, like follow the money. And each one brings a little piece to the table, and together they piece it together. And they find out that what's actually happening is worse than what they thought what was happening, but they caught it on time.
I see. Well, you pretty much explained the whole book.
It's very funny if you look at it from a squirrel perspective, how we live, right? Like, for instance, my children, they can't imagine a life without cell phones. You can't imagine what it was like when you had a question, you had to go to the library to dig up the right book to figure it out. And in this table, I can explain it, so to speak, from a new perspective, because my squirrels explain it to the refugee who is coming from outside and doesn't know how it works. And thereby I can show, so to speak, processes that people take for granted and they don't know what they're using it for.
Okay. My only question is whether there's enough entertainment value, dramatic entertainment value, and cliffhanger action for young people. You know, you've really got to catch them and capture their imagination before you can, you know, give them, lessons or leave them with some sort of moral. So it's hard for me to picture, just given your description, where the entertainment value is. I guess there must be lots of humor in it.
Bob is an editor, and Bob is an editor, Gisela, and he's a former teacher who to bring his students to Shakespeare, he actually wrote rap books to suck them in because they didn't want any part of Shakespeare. But once they get into rapping, they were willing to listen to the stories and they liked it. So he's looking for how you suck the young people in.
That's exactly the point of the book, because basically it's a rediscovery. Like, you could read this entire book, and coincidentally it happens that my editor is an Indian girl. So she doesn't know all of this. Right? She doesn't know the history of the United States. You could read the entire book without knowing that George Walton and Benjamin Franklin are really George Washington and Benjamin Franklin. And it would be what it is. But the way how it's written, it's like a rediscovery. Hey, I already know that, right? And so what are they going to do now? And it's funny from that perspective, right? And the Deer Express, of course, is the Pony Express and so on throughout the book. And it's kind of like a funny discovery. But Bob, I urge you, why don't you read the sample on Amazon and see if you like it?
I will. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
And good luck. Selling
your
book.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, John.
You're
welcome. Bye-bye.
What's next for you other than moving ahead with the illustration and everything? To what's next for you, Gisela?
Well, of course, that's only the first book. I mean, I set up this whole book in a way, if you so want, with the Star Wars pattern. You have an introduction of all these characters, and they are solving their one puzzle, but it's it's only a stepping stone. Now they're going to head on and do more things. So all the individual characters are now embarking on their own stories, and they all get their own book.
Oh, okay. Now, we've covered a lot of the bases tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Gisela Hausman?
Well, if I have learned anything in the 56 years that I've run around on this planet, then it is, if you don't go out and do it, nobody is going to do it. Waiting for something doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. And I also, this is basically the essence of my Tibet story. I see so many people who talk about trying to do things or wanting to do things, and they postpone them and postpone them, and maybe they'll do them 30 years later. But then it will be something different than what they thought it would be 30 years earlier, simply because everything changes, whether we want it or not. When I traveled Tibet in 1987, not one person would have guessed that anybody could build a train line there. Well, they finished it in 2006, and now they're building a second one there. So, and that's what's happening in all of our lives, right? I mean, if you wanted to write a book right now, then write it, you know? And if you want to travel, then travel, because life isn't waiting. In fact, I would think that things have gotten even more complicated since then, because now we have natural disasters, never ending, constantly, and so that poses a different problem.
Yes. Yes.
We have to take
absolutely
what we want. We have to grab everything we want and you know, go smart about it, because life isn't waiting, and there's always, just like in my army knots, my fable, there's always somebody pulling strings behind our backs.
But we are finding out more and more of that, I think, right now. I hope we are, anyhow. So, well,
I hope so, too. Which is another point. I mean, if I would encourage anybody to become, you know, an investigative reporter, or really, because that's what we need today. It's like the biggest demand for investigative reporters, Bob Woodward. That's what we need. And people are hungry for it because they don't want to do the work, so anybody who does it can find a never-ending field of activity and expertise and what have you. It's really good. I mean, it's really better than it was 10, 15 years ago.
The big concern is, though, with papers going away and with so much up on the Internet, can people make a living doing that? So.
What? I guess this is when it comes back to we have to investigate what we do. Personally, my favorite is Twitter. I mean, I've always stuck with that. I think that the concept is very smart. I think that the hashtag system works very well there. Facebook, on Facebook, hashtags are not really helpful. And so, yeah, my favorite is Twitter. What about you?
Okay. I'm on Facebook a lot, and I'm on email. I'm also writing a lot, and I'm also reading all around the area, because to one of the things I am, I'm the poet laureate of my local town here, so I am constantly reading in different places. So that's my main thing, reading, writing, and talking to the people. I am occasionally on.
Very important, too.
Yeah. Gisela, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me, John. I really enjoyed it.
I hope that all the audience will bring it back next week for my interview with Herb Roseman. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. Tune in next Sunday, and I think once again we'll go off with the Eagles. Alexa, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Playing Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library.
once again, thank you, Gisela. Now, good night,
thank
everybody.
You, Tom.